In the coming week, protests intensify in Lebanon and Chile, and the U.S. House of Representatives votes on rules for an impeachment inquiry. It's October 31st, 2019, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, earlier this month, the government in Lebanon proposed taxing the WhatsApp message service. Rather than raising revenue, the proposal has raised a ruckus. Protesters hit the streets. Their demands quickly morphed into a call for the overthrow of the country's ruling political class. Protesters got part of their wish this past Tuesday when Saad Hariri resigned as Lebanon's prime minister. Can you tell us a bit more about the protests and where they might be headed?
Sure, Jim. First, it's worth saying that this is not an isolated protest in the Middle East or in the world. They are happening everywhere, and there are all sorts of reasons. There seems to be a through line through many of them, which is problems emanating from flagrant inequality. Some of that is definitely the case in Lebanon. It's a resentment against the so-called elites and the way they have been mismanaging the country. And in Lebanon, it's particularly interesting because of the incredible mix, diversity of religious faiths and ethnicities and so forth that makes up Lebanon and Lebanese society, which is also one of the more curious and interesting democracies to follow in the Middle East. There was one account I read that kind of laid out the scope of problems that the Lebanese are facing and why this WhatsApp tax just sort of was the last straw. By the way, the tax, I think, would have amounted to something like $6 a month. So that amount was enough to sort of tip people over the edge to show these incredible scenes, especially in Beirut, of the large crowds. There was one report I read on the region saying Lebanese people face pressures that include very high unemployment, increasing public debt, crumbling infrastructure, stagflation, there's a term from the U.S. 1970s, a growing currency crisis, environmental catastrophe, and the burden of hosting about 1.5 million Syrian refugees. And by the way, that's roughly 20% of the country's population, if you do the math. So all of this is added up to these demonstrations, which sort of span different religious sects and clans and so forth, and have led to Mr. Hariri stepping down. What's interesting, though, is at the end of the day, when all is said and done, you could still have a government led by Mr. Hariri emerging from this crisis.
How does that happen, Bob?
It's because of the very sort of delicate balancing act among the ruling powers in Lebanon. And let's be clear, they're not going to step down and open the door for the public to step in and seize the reins of power because they represent different factions of society. So you have the Shiite-related parties and movements that are represented and also include, by the way, Hezbollah, which is the Iran-affiliated both militant movement but also increasingly political movement. You have Christians who are a minority but have become power brokers, and usually Christian serves as the president of Lebanon, and you have Sunnis. And then within them, you have multiple clans and so forth. Hariri is a Sunni who's been balancing between Saudi and Iranian pressures. In part, he comes from a family that was extremely powerful. His father, Rafiq Hariri, one of the wealthiest men in the country for years, was assassinated in a bomb attack that a UN tribunal has pegged to some Hezbollah officials. But he has been trying to balance the powers there and basically went on to national media and just said, I am unable to continue on in this capacity, and he's trying to work with various power brokers to set up what people are calling for, which is a technocratic government, basically some sort of a group that can come in with a skill set that will help engineer the country through its thicket of problems without getting swayed by all the different special interests. That's a lot easier said than done.
Yeah, I was going to say, Bob, how do you make that happen, given, as you point out, you have very strong religious communities that have historically struggled and fought each other for control of power, for control of the economy? Those divisions aren't going to go away. At the same time, as you point out, Lebanon is suffering from the consequences, the spillover from the Syrian civil war. And we're in a time in which the overall global economy seems to be slowing down. That seems to be a lot of strikes against this technocratic government, if it even comes to fruition.
No, that's right, Jim. And one possible scenario is that a couple of leaders emerge from representing different backgrounds in the country who have enough sway and who have the will to go ahead and try to forge such a coalition. But in this sort of a deal, somebody's interests would be trampled on. And it's
questioned. Oh, right.
And so let's think back to, I mentioned Rafiq Hariri, for example. One of his big initiatives was to, I think, lessen the Syrian Syrian influence on Lebanon. Many would say he paid for it with his life in terms of he was strong. He had a lot of sway. He ended up having an amount of independence that seemed threatening to outside powers. And if you follow the UN inquiry into his killing, that seems to be what happened.
So, but looking at this, so far the protests in Lebanon have been peaceful. We saw in the last 24 hours some violence. Are there concerns that that violence is going to ramp up? And should we be looking for potential outside meddling in Lebanon's politics? As you know, Bob, there's a long history of neighbors and other powers meddling in Lebanon.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I mentioned the Saudi-Iran influence. Hariri famously was stopped in Saudi Arabia and was said to have resigned there under Saudi pressure before emerging and taking up his business back in Lebanon. He has been, as I said, balancing influences from Hezbollah as well, even though Hezbollah figures have been linked to his father's killing. But it's interesting, you had the Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah, within the past week saying he was against the resignation of the cabinet. But, you know, at the end of the day, as I said, this is a society that, first of all, it's showing remarkable sort of civic control. And for a country, you know, built across so many different influences and religious disciplines and so forth, it is showing a peaceful nature that is, for example, missing in nearby Iraq, where protests have been the bloodiest among all the protests going on right now. But a part of this has been the control of security services, their unwillingness to use live ammunition on demonstrators and so forth. There has been concern that some of the chants that have turned against, let's say, Hezbollah and outside influences, namely Iran, could spark Hezbollah, which has a very potent armed affiliate, could come in and sort of crack down, and then you'd start to see all sorts of sectarian violence. Lebanon, look back at its history the past 40 years, a really bloody, awful civil war, and then different spurts of violence have occurred as well. And it's, again, back to our original point, Jim, that forging the kind of government that would need to be taking on these reforms is really difficult. The last time the factions tried to form a new cabinet, one report mentioned the process lasted 9 months.
Yeah, that's not encouraging, Bob. But as you noted at the top of the discussion, Lebanon is not the only place we're seeing an outbreak of protests. So let's go somewhere else where protests have made the news this week, and that is Chile. There, the protests erupted over what was roughly a nickel increase in the fare for public transportation. But unlike in Lebanon, the Chilean protests have been chaotic in violence. We've seen looting of stores and supermarkets, something on the order of 22 subway stations have been set on fire, and at last count, at least 19 people have died. Indeed, things have gotten so bad in Chile, which is usually seen as a model of success in Latin America, that the country's center-right president, Sebastián Piñera, declared a state of emergency and has announced that Chile is not going to host the APEC Forum and the so-called COP25 Environmental Summit. So can you fill us in on what's happening in Chile, Bob?
Sure, Jim. First, it's worth mentioning that this one probably is the most surprising of all the demonstrations that are going on around the world, partly because, as you said, Jim, Chile has been seen for many years as this paragon of democratic development and sort of the balancing of open market with democratic freedoms. It's sort of a leader on the world stage in these areas. Its former president is the chief UN human rights official. And yet, it's really actually a veneer, as we're finding out. One of the things that's come out in the reporting about how this is happening in Chile is that it is among the most unequal countries under the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. And again, this fare, this relatively minor fare, you know, as we saw with the tax proposal in Lebanon, this proposed fare increase was the last straw and just triggered this just outrage, I think. And it's really spilled over into a whole host of issues that Chilean society is upset about. I mean, you've already had actually the reversal of the subway fare increase. You've had the elimination of a proposed increase in electricity charges, or actually, I think the increase is already underway. You've had the government of Sebastián Piñera increasing minimum wages, things like pension benefits, raising taxes on the wealthy. There's been a major reshuffling of the cabinet. It hasn't seemed to have much influence. In fact, after all those steps, he had to come out and announce the cancellation of these two really high-profile and very prestige-building events in Chile because of the concern about not really knowing where things are going to be going in the country. So it's a place where there's going to have to be, again, potentially like Lebanon, there's a sense that there are deep-seated reforms that have to take place and that have to move beyond the current sort of political calculus. The president himself is a billionaire, and that is seen, I think, as sort of feeding sort of the outrage and frustration about inequality in the country. And so political parties, potentially, there's going to have to be some sort of deep-seated, you know, sort of dialogue that gets underway that talks about what needs to change in Chilean society. Things like basic issues like providing affordable health care and education, a sustainable pension, all the things that a lot of democracies struggle with, frankly. And certainly the United States debates many of these issues frequently, and it's playing out to some extent on the U.S. political campaign underway right now. But for Chile, with the inequality being so sharp, again, there are stakeholders, people who have high stakes in sort of the status quo, who will push against that. And the question is whether Piñera himself has enough heft to be able to sort of change it in meaningful ways and in credible ways so that this anger that is festering and continuing will subside.
Well, I would imagine, Bob, that one big question would be, can Piñera make the kinds of political changes needed in a time frame or time span that is going to satisfy the public mood? Just sort of looking at the protests from the outside, clearly people are angry. They want change now. But the list of issues you pointed to are issues that aren't going to be solved overnight. And even if you announce a new tax plan, it's going to take a while for the benefits of that plan to manifest themselves. So I guess the question is, are we seeing the potential for prolonged divisions in Chile and real threats to Chilean democracy?
I think the answer is potentially yes. As surprising as that sounds, given the stature that Chile has had in the region. And again, as in the Middle East, we have a region in which there are protests spilling out all over the place. You've just had another major democracy and economy with a change election in Argentina, where you had populists elected to power promising to turn around an economic program that was seen as not serving the people. But the fears there being that the country is going to become even more in debt and more sort of indebted to populist, you know, sloganeering. You have protests in Ecuador and Bolivia. Some of this is also based on the model of, I forgot to mention, the sort of the commodities dependency of the economies throughout the region. So are they going to be able to rebalance their economies in ways that make changes in things like copper prices, which is really important for a country like Chile, make them less important? It seems to be all a recipe for, you know, continuing these protests. And, you know, will they have any time to sort of create some sort of clear dialogue on things like constitutional changes? I don't know, Jim.
Yeah, Bob, I think you put your finger on a big factor, certainly in Chile and a number of other countries, that is the dependency upon selling commodities. And during boom times, commodity prices go up and you have a growing pie. So even if you have inequality, everybody's better off today than they were yesterday. Politics tends to be a lot more manageable. But in a situation that we have now, with a lot of commodity prices having fallen, in essence, going from a boom to a bust, problems that you might have been able to manage before all of a sudden become very, very visible. And it's politically difficult to handle them, in part because the economic conditions are not favorable to making the kind of changes or seeing the positive benefits that changes take place quickly. But one thing I want to actually ask you about is the consequences of the Chilean protests for international symmetry. As I mentioned in asking the question, President Piñera has announced 2 weeks ahead of the APEC summit meeting and the COP25 environmental summit that Santiago is not going to host either of them. So where does that go? Is the APEC summit off? Are we going to reconvene in neighboring Brazil? Any sort of clarity on what's going to happen on the summit front?
I have not seen a recent report since that announcement, Jim, that says with any sort of clarity, you know, where this might be happening. I've seen some tweets by President Trump, who's concerned about the ability of the U.S. and China to announce some sort of phase one trade deal. President Trump is tweeting that they're zeroing in on a alternate locale to be able to do that. By the way, those talks themselves are a subject of a lot of question marks right now. However, this is reverberating throughout the Pacific Rim, right? It's APEC. It's you're seeing media reports from as far away as Singapore expressing concern about what's going on here. I am not sure yet where an alternative venue might be. And if you look in South America, there's a great many countries dealing with their own domestic ferment at the moment, Jim. So it's not clear at all it's going to stay in the hemisphere. And as for the climate talks as well, the UN has many venues that it can find. I think there you might end up being something like a venue like Geneva might end up, you know, stepping in place of something. Santiago, for them to be able to review what they call the COP25, which in this case would be a conference reviewing the Paris Climate Agreement and where things stand there. It follows, though, we should note, a period of a great deal of attention on climate issues at the United Nations General Assembly kickoff in just last month, Jim, and, you know, the figure of Greta Thunberg of Sweden, the teenager, and a lot of other people movements talking about public protests, people movements in favor of doing something about reining in emissions seen as contributing to climate change. So two very important different summits involving issues like trade and climate, which have a great deal to do with the global health, Jim, and it's a little bit unsure where they're going to take place.
Yeah, I would imagine that even if they salvage any parts of either of these two meetings, they're going to be scaled way, way back because these summits take months and months of detailed planning. You have the whole issue of security, operations, getting schedules, coordinating schedules, having hotel space, all of the boring things that go into putting on a big summit. And it's virtually impossible to reconstitute that in the space of a couple of weeks.
No, good point. And you could, you know, it'd be interesting to see whether a group like APEC decides to switch its agenda up a little bit to address the very issue that caused the disruption of the summit in Chile in terms of, you know, issues of cost of living and global inequality and so forth.
Certainly would be very interesting.
Well, Jim, I want to take the conversation back to Washington. And although I'd like it to be about the Washington Nationals, who just won the World Series.
Congratulations to the Nationals and their fans.
And I could even find some international elements as well, but I'm going to resist the temptation, Jim. There's something else even bigger going on in Washington, and that is a movement by the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, to hold a vote on the rules that will govern the impeachment inquiry of President Trump. Jim, that vote will take place likely half an hour within finishing the taping of this podcast. We are going to speak in terms of a few assumptions, let's say, and some other longer-term issues to put some context around this issue. So, Jim, talk about the significance of this vote as it moves forward.
Certainly, Bob, and I think your question set it up properly. This is not a vote to authorize an impeachment inquiry. It is a vote on a resolution that sets out the terms for how the House is going to conduct its inquiry in its public face. So it deals with issues like what the rules are governing the public hearings. It designates that the Intelligence Committee will take the lead on those hearings, that it will prepare a report that will then go to the Judiciary Committee. Other things like the release of the transcripts from the depositions that have been held over the last few weeks in private, and a variety of other issues. Now, the immediate impact of this vote, and again, it looks pretty clear that it's going to pass. I will note that 228 Democrats are already on record favoring an impeachment inquiry, and you need just 218 votes for a resolution to pass.
And this would be a straight party line vote, we expect, yes?
Yeah. Bob, I would anticipate this will be a vote along straight party lines. Republicans have been arguing all along that the impeachment inquiry is illegitimate because there hasn't been a vote to authorize the impeachment. Now, again, this is not technically a vote to authorize the impeachment, but to set the rules of the road for the impeachment inquiry. But even having this vote, I don't think it's going to change Republican attitudes toward the underlying issue of impeachment of the president. Likewise, again, assuming this resolution passes, it's not likely to change the White House behavior. Now, if you notice, in a number of occasions, the White House has said it's not going to cooperate with Congress or with the House on the impeachment inquiry because there hadn't been a vote. But again, I don't think the fact that you're going to get this vote is going to change what's going to transpire in terms of the unwillingness of the White House to provide the information that the House is going to demand. I think it's clear, given today's vote, that a vote on impeachment is inevitable. It's hard to see the Democrats going this far and turning back. Big question is going to be, what is the impact of the public hearings that are going to be held this month? And I think it's also safe to say that this impeachment inquiry and the hearings that we're about to see are going to further paralyze policymaking in Washington. Right now, one of the big issues that we're facing is that come November 22nd, the government will shut down unless Congress and the president agree on a spending plan. It's not clear we're going to reach that agreement. Again, let's go back to the beginning of the year where we had the longest government shutdown because the White House and Capitol Hill couldn't come to agreement. If we do get, as seems likely, a vote to impeach the president, that would then kick the issue to the Senate, meaning we're likely to have a trial in the Senate in January. Again, big question as to how long that trial may last, but obviously it'll be happening just as we begin the formal nominating events for both parties for the 2020 presidential election.
And Jim, could you just quickly recap what the central issue is here, that the House, with all these witnesses they've been calling, and this continues, we may see former National Security Advisor John Bolton appear at some point, according to latest reports. Could you talk a little bit about what's at issue as this moves forward?
The core issue here, Bob, is whether President Trump held up U.S. aid for Ukraine, aid that had been approved by the United States Congress until it was willing to open a political investigation of former Vice President Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden. That's what the issue is about. And we've had a stream of witnesses come up to Capitol Hill. And based on what's been leaked about that testimony, it certainly seems that a number of the people who worked for President Trump believe that was the case. We'll find out more when the discussion moves to the public format and we have public hearings. But that's really the crux of the matter. The president insists that there was no quid pro quo, and he points to the transcript that the White House released earlier this month as showing that nothing had happened. What we now know is that transcript was not, contrary to what the president said, a verbatim transcript. It is a transcript that leaves out or has left out at least some elements of the conversation. In that sense, it was more a summary or a rough transcript than a verbatim transcript. And again, we'll learn a lot more when we go to the public hearing phase of this inquiry.
All right, well, let's take a break from the intense politics going on in Washington then and talk about it. Another figure that was making the rounds in Washington. That figure came from our Twitter poll of Figures of the Week, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. I'm pretty sure why the Twitter poll chose him, but Jim, could you talk a bit more about this figure?
Happy to, Bob. Obviously, Mr. Baghdadi was the 48-year-old Iraqi who was the head of the Islamic State. He died over the weekend in a U.S. Special Forces raid in the Idlib province in northwestern Syria, in an isolated compound about 4 miles from the Turkish border. As we understand it, he killed himself and two of his children by detonating a suicide vest as U.S. Special Forces operators were closing in on him. And I'll note, early reports indicated that 3 children had been killed, but the U.S. government has revised that to 2. The early story, and as you know, Bob is a former journalist, early stories can change, but the early story is that he was betrayed by a subordinate, apparently angry at how ISIS had treated his relatives. And this mole apparently fed intelligence to the Syrian Kurds, who then pass that intelligence along to their U.S. colleagues. Now, Baghdadi's rule was distinguished by his brutality, which I'm not going to recount, but he also had a unique ability to knit the remnants of what was the old Iraqi army, the old Baathists, as well as religious zealots from as many as 100 countries into a significant fighting force. At the height of the Islamic State's operations in late 2014, early 2015, it controlled as much as 40,000 square miles of territory in Iraq and Syria. That's roughly the size of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I think the big question many people are asking is, will his death make a difference in the fight against Islamic extremism? Historical records suggest probably not. We've seen the killing of terrorist leaders like Osama bin Laden, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and Anwar al-Awlaki, and that hasn't diminished the threat. That doesn't mean that the Islamic State is likely to reconstitute itself as a territorial entity. That's probably not going to happen, but it's certainly still capable of carrying out terrorist attacks in Syria, in Iraq, and beyond. The Pentagon estimates that there are as many as 14,000 Islamic State fighters still operating in Iraq and Syria. And the one big question from the raid is, what information were U.S. Special Forces able to find at the Baghdadi compound? And does that provide usable intelligence to break other Islamic State networks?
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating to follow. And then it's obviously set off a whole bunch of other discussions about reinforcing the intense debate about the role of U.S. forces in Syria and the value of them being there with Syrian Kurdish allies versus operating more remotely. It now looks like the latest numbers we're seeing about the number of U.S. forces on the ground in Syria, albeit in a different location, is close to what we had seen already. We had seen close to 1,000. The latest reports are now that 900 are going to remain, many of them protecting these oil fields in the east so that ISIS-related forces could not benefit from oil revenues. And then, of course, it's a question of, as our colleague Bruce Hoffman has raised, whether groups like Al-Qaeda, which is still around, comes in and takes advantage of, say, a vacuum in ISIS leadership to seize the reins of the jihadi movement once again and cause a lot of problems.
Well, certainly. And I think critics of President Trump's decision to remove U.S. support for the Syrian Kurds and to talk, at least initially, about pulling out U.S. troops from Syria would point to this operation and say, this is why the United States should be in Syria. Very small commitment in terms of number of troops, but high leverage. That is a big payoff for a relatively small investment. And that by walking away from the Kurds, we're going to make it harder for ourselves to do these sort of operations going after terrorists who, while they are geographically or physically based in Syria or in Iraq, pose a threat beyond the region. I think we're going to see that debate continue for quite some time. But what about you, Bob? Who or what is your figure of the week?
So, Jim, my figure is a number, and I'm going to draw it from the same region in a way, as we'll see. The number is, it's actually a vote, 405-11. That was the bipartisan vote in the U.S. House on a resolution that recognizes the Armenian genocide. This is something that has reportedly, and with a good deal of validity, been reported that it occurred about 100 years ago in Turkey against ethnic Armenians. 1.5 million, I believe, were killed in this genocide. And Turkey has vehemently fought against any sort of recognition of this. They do not acknowledge it as a genocide and point to a whole other set of developments going on at the time that resulted in some ethnic Armenian deaths. Suffice it to say that the Turkish pushback on this and previous efforts to vote on such a resolution have been successful, but such is the case of the Turkish stature, in at least in the House, among both Democrats and Republicans, that they lost a resounding vote on this. It's a very symbolic vote. There's no sign it's going to come up for a vote in the Senate, for example. It's a non-binding resolution, and yet any sort of such votes, especially by a Turkish treaty ally, as is the U.S., are taking very hard, and the response has been very angry.
Bob, why have successive Turkish governments fought the designation of the killing of Armenians as a genocide, given that the killings weren't carried out by the government of Turkey, but the predecessor Ottoman Empire?
It's a really good question, Jim. I think it deals with Turkishness and Turkish identity. I think it potentially resonates with any Turkish activities that take place up to the present day, let's say against Kurds, who are a large minority in Turkey. And it's seen as a slight against this sort of Turkish nationhood writ large, despite the actual formal beginnings of the modern Turkish state, that they just refuse to acknowledge. There is just, as I said, there's just been a pronounced denial to recognize any sort of campaign like this because they see it as a stain on Turkish people writ large. Jim, how about you? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, my figure of the week is a person, and I'm going to go with Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. He finally got a big win in the House of Commons, but it wasn't a win about pulling the United Kingdom out of the European Union. As you know, today is October 31st. That was supposed to be the deadline for Britain to ditch the EU, even though Prime Minister Johnson said he would rather die in a ditch than ask for the deadline to be extended. That's exactly what he did. And the EU earlier this week granted Britain a 3-month extension until January 31st of 2020. Even so, Johnson may still get the last laugh. His big win came when he got the overwhelming backing of the House of Commons to hold a general election on December 12th. That's 6 weeks from now. It'll be the first December election in Britain in 96 years, and it'll be the fourth time in less than 5 years that British voters have gone to the polls. Now, by all accounts, this vote is a high-stake gamble by Johnson. He's hoping he's going to get a majority of members of Commons elected and committed to his Brexit plan. People who've been following the Brexit saga may remember that his predecessor, Theresa May, made the same calculation back in 2017, and it backfired big time on her as the Conservatives, or Tories, lost seats. Again, I think people following the news coming out of the United Kingdom will note that this is going to be framed as a should we stay or should we go election. That is, you know, are British voters going to vote for essentially Johnson's plan to leave the EU or the Labour Party proposal for a second referendum? And that referendum, as I understand it, is going to give voters a choice between leaving with a sensible deal, whatever that means, or remaining in the European Union. But I would caution people that it's more complicated than that. And I think one real question British voters are going to be asking themselves is, do they want Jeremy Corbyn as prime minister? And one of the very interesting dynamics in British politics right now is that many of the people who oppose Brexit also oppose seeing Jeremy Corbyn become prime minister. And all of this is going to be complicated by the fact that in Great Britain, like in the United States or in Canada, it's a first-past-the-post system. What that means is that none of the parties necessarily need to win a majority of the votes in order to win a majority of the seats. So what that means is people should treat national polls in Great Britain quite cautiously. But again, we're looking at three potential outcomes. One is that Boris Johnson wins, gets his majority. In that case, I think you're going to see Britain leave the United Kingdom. You could also see Jeremy Corbyn win, and that will give us uncertainty because you'll have to have the second referendum. And what that referendum actually says, I think, will be a matter of great contention, and it'll take a long time under British law to actually pull it together. And then finally, there's the possibility that, once again, the British voters disagree among themselves about what to do, and we end up, in essence, perpetuating where we currently are. So again, the Brexit saga really is what seems to be a never-ending saga.
Yeah, I think of the term Brexhaustion is definitely showing how overwhelming this issue has become. Jim, I guess we'll circle back in December and January and take stock, but I wouldn't be placing any bets with the British bookie on this.
Neither would I, Bob.
Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The UK takes over presidency of the UN Security Council, and ASEAN leaders hold a summit in Bangkok.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge and Caroline Cantis for their assistance. This week, our recording engineers were Anthony LeBarry and Nick Sander. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long.